The following is a production of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.
This program was sponsored by Northern Trust.
Bringing citizens and citizen soldiers together through the exploration of military history, topics, and current affairs. This is Pritzker Military Presents.
Welcome to Pritzker Military Presents with award-winning World War II historians Gerhard Weinberg and Rebecca Whitman, discussing the liberation of Europe. I'm your host, Ken Clark, and this program is one of four episodes of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library's On War Military History Symposium, sponsored by Northern Trust. This program, and more than 400 others covering a full range of military history and affairs, is available on demand at PritzkerMilitary.org. Exploring the fact that liberation meant different things to different peoples at the end of World War II, historians Weinberg and Whitman offer a variety of perspectives on the reality of what is commonly thought of as a glorious end to a horrific war. What were the actual experiences like for guards, prisoners, or even liberators themselves? And how does our collective memory of liberation differ across cultures, generations, and in history books? Dr. Weinberg is a German expatriate and veteran of the U.S. Army during the occupation of Japan following World War II. A professor emeritus of history at the University of North Carolina, Dr. Weinberg is an internationally recognized authority on the origins and course of World War II, earning the 2009 Pritzker Literature Award for his writings on the subject. Dr. Whitman is Chair of Historical Studies and Associate Professor of History at the University of Toronto, where her research focuses on the Holocaust and post-war Germany. Dr. Whitman is the author of Beyond Justice, The Auschwitz Trial, winner of the Frankel Prize in Contemporary History, and is now at work on a second book entitled Nazism and Terrorism, Guilt and Shame in Post-War Germany.
We think today of the end of the war 70 years ago, the European part, as a form of liberation. And for many people, especially in Western Europe, it was liberation. We need to recall that people in Denmark and Norway had been occupied in April of 1940, that the Dutch, Belgians, Luxembourgers, and most of the French have been occupied since the summer of 1940. Needless to say, the people there were happy to be liberated. Because of the delay imposed on the Western powers by the German offensive that we now call the Battle of the Bulge, the armies of Canada, Britain, the United States, and France were not able to drive into Germany substantially until starting again in February of 45. One of the things that they discovered was the reality of German concentration camps. And for their inmates, this was liberation indeed. For the guards, in some instances, it meant either death at the hands of the former inmates or summary execution by some of the Allied soldiers. In the East, the Red Army had resumed its offensive, in part a few days early at our request, in January of 1945, and therefore had overrun Auschwitz and other death camps before, chronologically before, the Americans and Brits liberated camps. What we need to recall today, I would suggest, is that these last measures in the spring of 45 meant very different things for inmates of camps, the guards of those camps, and the German population in Central Europe who were now occupied by Allied forces coming from the East and the West, meeting in the middle of the country, and in mid-July, moving to the previously agreed upon occupation zones and sectors of Berlin. For the German population, obviously, this meant something very different. Furthermore, with the unconditional surrender in May, quite literally millions of German soldiers found themselves as prisoners of war, added to the prisoners of war taken in preceding years and months, both in the West and in the East. So liberation meant something different to different people. I think that's an aspect of this end of the war in Europe that we need to keep in mind as we think of it and as we use the term liberation.
It's interesting when I think about, I think the general perception, you're right, about liberation is a purely positive sort of a glorious moment in history. And I think that it tends to be a very North American perspective, and in many ways also a correct one for some. And as you're saying, it's not necessarily the case for everybody. And the perspective that I look at liberation from is, on the one hand, the extraordinary relief for those who finally found themselves out of harm's way to a certain extent. But the fact is that also many still continued to die after liberation. On the other hand, I look at it also from the perspective of what this meant for Germans in terms of guilt and shame and the way that this continues afterwards. And I would say that in many ways that is the result both of the way that the Allies in Germany dealt with the German population, especially those who lived very close to concentration camps that were liberated, but also the ways in which perpetrators, guards from camps and so on especially, were dealt with, both by the Allies and then later by the Germans. And in some ways, you see a trend in which many, many Germans feel that they are kind of off the hook for responsibility because of the focus on camp guards, especially in terms of trials or summary executions, first by the Allies and then by the Germans. And the work that I do largely deals with how the Germans deal with their own past. So it's very interesting to contemplate the ways that the sort of early shaping of the process of the end of war and the giving responsibility to a few allows many Germans to remove themselves from the sense of responsibility. And so as you say, it's a very, very different mixed bag for different people. And you touched on a little bit what it means to be liberated in the East, where one goes from one occupation to another. And that's something that you know a great deal about, obviously. And how would you, I mean, if you thought about this, how would you categorize or conceptualize what it means? Does it even mean liberation in the East?
Yes, for very large numbers in Eastern Europe, it means anything but liberation. As the Allies, after the First World War, had set up a system whereby the Soviet Union, which had come under communist control at the end of 1917, was pushed back from Central and Eastern Europe, and a whole batch of people in Poland and in Southeast Europe secured independence from the German, Austro-Hungarian, Russian, and Ottoman empires. But the insistence of the Germans on starting another world war then brought the Soviet Union from its 1920-21 borders into the middle of Europe. And that meant for the people of the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, the people of Poland, the people of Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Romania, Bulgaria, Yugoslavia, it meant communist rule, which had a basis in small communist parties in each of those countries, but where the overwhelming majority of the population, the statistics differ from country to country, but in all of them, and I stress that, in all of them, it was the majority of the population. The last thing they wanted was the Red Army to make it possible for the Soviet leadership to install communist governments. This was a process that took a number of years, but it was very clear what the future would bring. And they certainly did not feel liberated. And one of the aspects of this which I think is indicative to us of what was going on was that during the war, the Germans had brought from Eastern Europe millions of prisoners of war and even more millions of forced laborers into Germany to work in factories, mines, and farms to replace Germans who were needed for the German military. When the war ends, a lot of these don't want to go home. That is to say, home is now not a liberated Belgium, France, or Norway. Home is now a communist-dominated Poland or Estonia or whatnot. And so while lots of the so-called DPs, which was the abbreviation for displaced persons and liberated prisoners of war, lots of them go home to France, to Belgium, to the Netherlands. Obviously, the United States and Britain are very interested in recovering their own soldiers who'd been captured by the Germans. But lots of others don't want to go back. And that means that liberation for them means a new search for a place to live, a country that is willing to admit them. What we tend to forget in this country is that for the people of much of Central and Eastern Europe, the insistence of the Germans in starting another war means that their real liberation is postponed for 50 years, for half a century in effect, until the collapse of Soviet government in the Soviet Union itself, in East Germany, and in the various countries of Central and Eastern Europe. This is just a part of the impact, if you will, or effect or result, whatever term you prefer, of the Second World War.
One can think of countless examples of this, and when I think about, for example, looking at trial testimony of survivors of Auschwitz, the story you get about liberation is quite horrifying. It's, first of all, many of those who were in a place, places like Auschwitz, were marched out by the Nazis before the Soviets could get there, and found themselves marched in the middle of winter to some of the camps that you see liberated by the Americans and the British in Germany. And those images, which are the most prevalent, I think, in our minds in North America, of liberated camps, where especially soldiers took footage of some extraordinarily horrifying scenes of emaciated bodies and so on. Those are often forced laborers and slave laborers, and often people who had been marched to the West. And once they are liberated, of course, there is this gratitude and this great feeling initially of relief and, you know, suddenly being allowed to eat food and being free. But then, as you said, where does one go? And the survivor testimony shows people, countless people, trying to go back home, sometimes not knowing what they'll find if it's in, you know, in Hungary or Czechoslovakia or Poland, and finding their homes inhabited by others, finding themselves chased away from their former homes by guns, sometimes murdered after they have survived a death camp or a concentration camp. Or if they do manage to somehow find a place of refuge, carefully, slowly making their way sometimes towards North America, towards Montreal or towards Toronto or towards Chicago, and facing hardship here, anti-Semitism, suspicion, a sense of anxiety about these people who are destitute in their midst. And so, as you say, it's by no means a happy picture for a lot of those liberated. On the other hand, and it's a very interesting thing to contemplate, there's a real paradox when one thinks about, for example, what it means for Poland, for Jews in Poland. The end of the war does not necessarily mean a great sense of relief there. Poland remains a kind of a terrifying anti-Semitic place in many ways. And on the other hand, if one looks at the way that camp guards are dealt with in a place like Poland by tribunals, Soviet tribunals, Polish tribunals, they're dealt with very harshly, rightfully so. And they are very often either tried or not tried, executed, but they are dealt with through tribunals very quickly and very swiftly. So you have this paradox of sort of swift justice against Nazi camp guards in the East, in places like the Auschwitz tribunals that happened, and a much slower and a much less less sort of pressing sense of justice when some of these camp guards return to Germany and go back to their jobs as doctors, as lawyers, as car salesmen, and it takes sometimes 2 decades for them to get put on trial if they do at all. So again, I just want to sort of give you a sense of a very complex picture, which involves extraordinary hardship for many who have been liberated, and very, very sort of either swift justice or delayed justice, depending on where that occurs in the East and in the West.
Yes, as you may all have noticed in the newspapers lately, one of the Auschwitz people has just been on trial in Germany in the last few weeks, and it's a considerable number of years since he was there. One of the reasons that so many of the guards end up in the West rather than being picked up is because, as was just mentioned, they are being marched westward as the Red Army advances. And one has to keep in mind that the German guards are very, very interested in doing this. Mm-hmm. If you are not guarding and shepherding along the route emaciated, sick, unarmed Jews and other inmates of camps, your alternative assignment, everybody knows, is the front, where the people you have to deal with are well-armed, Russian, British, American, French, Canadian soldiers. Mm-hmm. So Ironically, the regime's high priority for killing Jews coincides with the high priority of guards for not being in the alternative assignment of frontline duty. Mm-hmm. They have a vested interest in continuing the Holocaust and the death marches to the very end. And while this is not a very nice way to describe them, they're not all particularly nice people. So we need to keep in mind that these terrible developments have their own impact not only on the victims, but also on the guards and the administrators, mm-hmm. who very quickly develop vested interest in them. In the early part of World War II, this is the route to promotions, to medals, to wonderful careers after Germany wins the war, to loot, occasionally to sex. But in the latter part of the war, which is what we're talking about, it is the vested interest in the alternative assignment being a most dangerous and unwelcome one. And so that's how we end up, that is the British, the Americans, the Canadians, and French, end up seeing camps which have most recently been overwhelmingly populated by inmates marched, driven from further east. The horrendous situation that the British encounter when they liberate the camp Bergen-Belsen in northern Germany, the camp where Anne Frank died before she could be liberated. A lot of those people, the inmates, are there because they were brought there in the last preceding half year. The other side of this is that, at least in the West, the Allies make a deliberate policy of driving the inhabitants of nearby communities to the camps so they can't pretend afterwards that they didn't know what was going on. Of course, when the war is over, no German ever knew anything about anything. The reality we tend to forget was opposite. When the concentration camps are created in 1933, the government does everything possible to publicize, not conceal, but publicize their existence, because this is a good way to encourage people to behave along the government's guidelines. I recall as a kid in school in the 30s, kids saying to each other, you better behave or you're going to the KZ, the concentration camp. Everybody in the country knew, but after it was all over, nobody knew anything. And to engage this, as I said, the Allies occasionally drive German civilians from nearby communities to these. One other thing, and in this area, General Eisenhower, who was the Allied Supreme Commander in the West, insists on lots of picture taking, because the experience, we tend to forget that. All the top leaders of World War II are survivors of World War I. And their experiences and how they interpret them of World War I and its post-war developments influences what they do in World War II. After World War I, there was a huge propaganda campaign initiated by the Germans to discredit all talk of German atrocities in Belgium and elsewhere. Eisenhower insists on lots of witnesses and movie making in Ohrdruf and other camps liberated by American and other Allied troops, so that people afterwards can't say, oh, well, this was all Allied propaganda. There weren't any such things, because the pictures and the accounts are there. This is an aspect, if you will, of the liberation that is important. Obviously, there are, as you probably know, people who still insist that none of these things ever happened. Those 6 million Jews who were murdered are all living in hiding someplace and have simply not told their grieving relatives where they are. But the reality is beyond dispute, and there was this deliberate effort to take pictures, to make records, to interview people, so that nobody could say afterwards, oh, well, this was just Allied propaganda to make the Germans feel bad and to justify what happened. There is another aspect to this, as it applies to both Germans and non-Germans, is the Germans had denounced the 1919 peace settlement because one of the major principles on which the peacemakers in 1919 operated was to adjust the boundaries in Europe to the population so that as few people as possible would be governed by individuals of a different nationality. Adjust the boundaries to the people, and where it's unclear, let the people vote. I'm German, I'm Polish, I'm whatever. The Germans thought this was an outrageous procedure and substituted in World War II the opposite. Draw the boundaries and then adjust the people. To make the Germans happy, the Allies decided they would adopt their principle at the end of World War II. Draw the boundaries and shove the people. What this meant in practice in Europe, that 12 million Germans lost their homes. Obviously, this did not immediately make them happy, though eventually they became integrated into what is now the Unified Federal Republic of Germany. The other side of this is that countries like Poland and Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia, which once had very large German minorities that were very unhappy, in part at least, at being governed by, imagine, being governed by Polish authorities, Czech authorities, these racially inferior Slavic people. But the other side of that was that Poland and Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia no longer had to worry about German minorities that were likely to align themselves with some other country and destroy their homeland country. This is a part of the process in Central and Eastern Europe, which has its positive and its negative sides, and is the result of the Allied victory and imposition of this new alternative concept to the one applied in 1919. Instead of adjusting the boundaries to the people, they adjust the people to the boundaries.
Just to pick up on that, it's extraordinary to think of the Germany we have today, in which approximately 800,000 refugees are being brought in. How did we get to this Germany? And these are the kinds of questions that I ask. From the Germany that you're just describing, which was largely rubble, largely had lost its male population, its adult male population, and was now having to somehow integrate 12 million expellees from the East who had been shoved into Germany, was marched through its own concentration camps that it had pretended not to know about, was basically a land of loss, of failure, of bombed out territories. And now somehow, within a very, very short period of time, becomes this economic wonder in the 1950s, becomes the main front line, talking about West Germany, ally to the Americans in the Cold War, and becomes a place that thrives as a democracy, and once unified, is really at the forefront of bringing in those who you would never imagine Germans 70 years before allowing in. And it's a very interesting process to think about, especially when you see the ways that certain things, especially on the legal front, fail so miserably. So you have all of these former Nazis somehow coming back in, living in West Germany, together with expellees, together with those who feel themselves to have been victims as well, somehow trying to quickly go from being the great enemy of the Allies to being their ally as well in the Cold War, and then how to deal with all these Nazis who are still in the midst of the West Germans. And that brings me again, you just mentioned this trial that's been happening recently of Oskar Gröning, who was known as the bookkeeper of Auschwitz, a man in his 90s, tried as an accomplice in the death of approximately 300,000 people. Those are the charges against him. And was initially was going to be convicted as an accomplice and sentenced to 3.5 years. The prosecution manages to get him 4 years. Imagine you are an accomplice to the death of 300,000 people and that's your sentence. This is a story that is told over and over and over in Germany from the beginning of the Ministry of Justice in West Germany in 1949 until the present day, that the vast majority of these people who came back and lived productive lives in Germany or elsewhere get a bit of a slap on the wrist and then are reintegrated into society. So how is it then that a country that deals with its past so poorly on the legal level, I would say, yet manages to become such a thriving, extraordinarily, democratic state that is upheld as a place where things are happening that should be happening throughout the rest of Europe and certainly aren't happening in places like Hungary? It's a strange and extraordinary path that starts at this moment of liberation, really, and that the Allies are integral in. But it is by no means just a simple picture of the end, the war is lost by the Germans, won by the Allies, and happy ending. By no means is that the case. It is a very long, awkward, tortured process towards what's happening now in Germany, which also, by the way, is one that is fraught and is a subject of great debate throughout Europe. And yet, I would say that in many ways, precisely because of those images that we have that came out of liberation, those images that you just referred to, that the German government is now determined to atone and to show that this is not a place that will ever do this kind of thing to refugees, to displaced people again.
Well, during the war, the Western Allies were very clear in their thinking, their leadership. When it's over, the Germans will get a raw deal, and the Japanese will get a new deal. Two very simple indications. The German head of state, Admiral Dönitz, is arrested, tried, and sent to jail. The Japanese head of state remains emperor until his death in the 1980s, not arrested, not tried, nothing.
Yeah.
The last occupation troops leave Japan in 1952. The last occupation troops leave Germany in 1994. One of the major aspects of what the Allies came to call re-education. And perhaps one of the more successful ones was discussed in the summer of 44 when they were talking about the bombing of Germany. They reminded themselves of the fact that the three wars of German unification had all been fought outside Germany. The First World War had been fought 99% outside Germany. For Germans, therefore, war meant losses and some deprivation, but the damage was elsewhere. One of the things that the bombing of cities taught the Germans was that if you do not want your house to burn, it is best not to set the world on fire. This was a part, in a sense, of the Allied re-education program that worked rather effectively. The Germans are probably the most pacifist people in the Europe of today. And in many German cities, Berlin, Hamburg, and others, they have deliberately left one of the big built churches in ruins from the bombing so that people around can see what happens when you set the world on fire. The other side that I think we need to keep in mind is that while it took years of re-education, internal development, and rethinking for the Germans to redevelop something of a democratic society of the sort that the vast majority of them had rejected at the end of the 1920s and beginning of the 1930s, in Western Europe, with some minimal exceptions, it is possible for the people to pick up where they left off. And when they have economic troubles, the United States in the Marshall Plan helps the people of what had been occupied Norway, Denmark, Holland, Belgium, France, etc., to rebuild, recover. It is, as I said, in Eastern Europe that the war, in effect, sets them back for 50 years until they can regain their independence realistically. There has been some economic recovery in the years after 45, but the Soviet regime very deliberately, consciously, and publicly prohibits, I use the term advisedly, prohibits any East European country from accepting Marshall Plan aid. While for the people of those countries who had been through the war, lived there, survived the war, this was not one of the nicest things the Soviet Union did for them. Prohibit them from accepting American aid. The reality was that they had to struggle all the harder to try to rebuild their lives after first German and then Red Army occupation. This was the reality. In the West, I would suggest that the only country where apartheid had been really devastated, and we tend to forget this, was Norway, because the northeastern corner, a part of Norway, is where in the fighting in 1945, the Red Army had advanced, and the Germans, against the possibility of the Red Army advancing further, had quite deliberately and consciously burned every building, destroyed every bridge, and quite literally had devastated everything. the effort to do this in the Netherlands, in Belgium, in the Luxembourg and France didn't come off. So the Allied armies moved too fast. And at the critical point, which was Paris, the local commander, General Colditz, simply refused to carry out Hitler's order to blow up the Eiffel Tower, destroy the Louvre, blow up Notre Dame Cathedral, etc., etc. And as a Canadian scholar from Toronto has pointed out, I think quite correctly, the reconciliation between France and Germany after the war was enormously facilitated by the fact that Paris was not leveled as Hitler had ordered, and the local commander simply refused to implement this. If that had happened, if he had done that, the French would have very long remembered the destruction of their cathedrals and churches and museums and so on and so forth. The other side of this is that the Germans had done that, had leveled everything in Warsaw. And the post-war government, including its communist leadership, had the city rebuilt. And the old part, if you're ever there, you will be surprised, rebuilt the way it was in the 16th, 17th, and 18th century. And when German cities quit building trash modern on to replace the ruins in the late 40s, 50s, early 60s, and began to try to rebuild the old parts of town the way they once were, they got the experts to help them do this from Poland. They had experience. They had just successfully done this. So there was this interesting exchange of expertise. The Germans knew how to level a city, and the Poles knew how to rebuild the old part so it still looks again as it did 300, 400, 500 years ago. That's an aspect of liberation that I have always thought is both ironic and very, very sensible. If you want to do something, you get someone who's expert at it. And several German cities, governments independently came to the same conclusion.
Yeah, but you know, those bombed out German cities, where those reminders are left of what happens when you set the world on fire, one mustn't imagine that Germans necessarily took this message and swallowed it and moved forward happily. There was a great deal of resentment. A great deal of resentment about those reminders. And where, of course, some would look at those reminders, like the Gedächtniskirche in Berlin, and say, this is what happens when you set the world on fire, and we shouldn't do this again. For most, it was a source of deep frustration that, we civilians who didn't know about these camps, as you say, of course they did, we civilians with our children had to experience unbelievable suffering, firebombing by these allies who are so-called not perpetrators of war crimes. Many Germans perceived it very differently. And certainly not on any official level was this acknowledged, but the chatter amongst the people in Germany, in the bakeries, in the grocery stores, was, but we suffered too, and now we're having our noses rubbed in crimes committed by that horrific madman Hitler, who we never really liked anyway, all of which was a very different story between until the war started to turn. And now here we sit having to rebuild when we really didn't do anything wrong. And this is a... As I mentioned, this is a story that was not told on the official level, and that, for example, in the Adenauer government in the early period, people were told really, and I think in some ways necessarily, to look forward, to think about rebuilding rather than looking backwards. And so that meant that they were not to focus on their own suffering and not to talk about it because that would be an international scandal, but also not to really think about the crimes that they had committed, but build, move forward, move into democracy, and really only very recently with the, I would say in the early 2000s, with the bombing and the move into Iraq by the British and the American allies, did Germans start talking about what they considered to have been war crimes committed by the allies at the end of the Second World War, during the Second World War, with the bombing of German cities. And some of this in an extraordinarily offensive way. Scholars who had always talked about the horrors of what Germans had done, suddenly in their later years, writing about the horrors of the bombing of German cities as though somehow these were equatable. Very, very strange sort of return of the repressed, you could say. So it's a very mixed picture in terms of the way that German citizens saw themselves as victims, couldn't really talk about themselves as victims, never saw themselves as perpetrators, despite the fact that many, many hundreds of thousands of them were, but simply tried to put their nose to the ground and move forward and rebuild with the help, of course, of the Allies. And that they did very successfully. But what comes out of this is a very unhealthy relationship to their own suffering, which of course happened, but also to their own guilt and responsibility, which many were able to sweep under the rug. And this was aided by Allied amnesties that occurred in the early 1950s of many thousands of those who had been convicted of war crimes and of terrible atrocities, amnesties that happened, of course, in order to deal with the new war, the Cold War, rather than the hot one, but also by the sort of wholesale acquittal of many, or not even investigation of many, Nazis in their midst. So you have this, you have on the one hand this extraordinary attempt to re-educate. Oh, you have a real resistance to it by many as well, and a refusal to be re-educated. And I would say that much of that re-education really comes through the next generation, and certainly not all of them, but those who are born either during or immediately after the war, who go to universities in the 50s, and who do not make the majority of the next generation, but who make up sort of this post-war left-wing intellectual who wants to know what on earth their parents actually did during the war, since they refused to talk about it, either their own suffering or their own guilt. And they want to know why their professors don't teach about 1933 to 1945 in the universities, why their doctors and lawyers and so on all are former Nazi Party members. And it's this next generation who start asking questions and who start saying in the late 60s, in the 70s, in the wake of the Auschwitz trial, in the wake of what they consider to be very, very repressed refusals to acknowledge what happened, they start asking questions. What actually did happen? And why aren't you telling us? And it's through them, I would say, that Germany becomes re-educated more so than through the policies of the Allies in the 40s and 50s.
Well, there is the other side, I would suggest, to the liberation issue, and that is that it opens for people in Europe after two horrendous wars, of which the first cost over 30 million deaths, and the second more than twice that many, the possibilities of reconciliation. And certainly a critical part of this is the reconciliation between France and Germany. And it is, I would suggest, very important in this regard that on the French side, The key figure who pushes for this reconciliation is General de Gaulle. Nobody could accuse him of being a collaborator with the Germans in World War II. Just the opposite. He was the one who had opposed the armistice the French government signed with Germany in 1940 and had led the Free French in continued fighting against Germany. On the German side, Professor Whitman just mentioned Chancellor Adenauer. There was a man who, and this is too often forgotten in my opinion, had been in the 1920s an advocate already of reconciliation with France. And in the 1920s, that was about the least popular, most unpopular line that anybody in German politics could push. Having argued for reconciliation with France in the 1920s, nobody could say in the late 1940s and 1950s, when Adenauer is the Chancellor of West Germany, that this is just sort of moving with the time, that this is an expedient notion on his part, when it is clear that that's been his view when it was most unpopular. And eventually, although this takes longer because of the background, there are those in both Germany and Poland who argue in favor of reconciliation. Once upon a time, the major idea of first Prussian and then German ideas was to destroy Poland and bring Russia into Middle Europe as far as possible. The 1945 experience taught most Germans who think about it the notion that this was not the smartest idea they ever had. That perhaps after the Russians are in Berlin for the second time, maybe it would be better to reconcile with Poland. And it was, after all, the German Chancellor Helmut Kohl who argues for the admission of Poland to NATO. And while there are terrible memories on both sides, German and Polish, there is a process of reconciliation which is inconceivable if the Germans had won in World War II and exterminated all those Poles who did not have, from the German perspective, Germanic features and could be Germanized. And that, from the German perspective, was a tiny minority. It was tens of thousands of children that they kidnapped, but in terms of the total population of the country, it was very small. That no reconciliation would ever have been possible under those circumstances. The Allied victory, even though it meant for Poland the years of communist rule, at least opened the possibility, which I would argue is very important, for a reconciliation between the French and the Germans in the West and between the Germans and the Poles in the East. It is a part of this process in 1945 that we tend not to pay much attention to because these are developments which take many years, but would be inconceivable if the Allies had not won and liberated most of Europe in 1945.
I'd like to thank Professors Whitman and Weinberg and just leave a little bit of time for questions.
Now it's your turn.
Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, has insisted that the Holocaust occurred, that the idea of destruction of the Jews by Hitler was due to instigation by Arab leaders?
Well, he has since repudiated his own mistaken view on this subject. In April of 1920, I repeat the date, April 1920, in a big speech to a cheering audience in Munich, Hitler called for the total extermination of the Jews. This was something he wanted from the start, but as he explained to those Germans in the 1930s who argued for the beginning of the killing of the handicapped and elderly, we can do this only when there's a war on. And so when the war starts, that's when the killing of the handicapped gets underway. And when the invasion of the Soviet Union starts, the systematic, not individual, but systematic killing of the Jews begins.
To what extent did the Cold War hinder the prosecution and reconciliation in Germany of the history of the Nazi atrocities?
I wouldn't say initially that the Cold War had a strong effect, but it changes, not in terms of prosecution, it changes in terms of amnesties. So at the very beginning, the Allies are determined to work together already beginning in 1943 to figure out a way to bring the major Nazi war criminals to trial. And they have all sorts of discussions about how this is going to occur and who's going to be tried and in what forum. And they, of course, come up with initially the Nuremberg trials, which is where all four Allies participate. But then the subsequent Nuremberg trials, which are undertaken by the Americans, and then many other different tribunals. There are Soviet tribunals, there are Polish tribunals, there are British trials, all sorts of trials. There are also, and there's more and more research being done about this now, many U.S. Army trials which happen, in which many thousands are convicted. And the initial process, I think, really is undertaken with the goal of putting Nazism on trial, not necessarily the Holocaust, but certainly Nazi war crimes on trial, and trying to deal in a most effective manner with these Nazi crimes. Where the Cold War comes in most certainly is in the late 1940s and into the 50s, where the Allies are starting to leave Germany and find ways to allow it to, especially West Germany, to sit on its own unoccupied. This is certainly the case when they start wholesale amnestying virtually all of those who are still in prison. And by 1951, the vast majority, with exception of some of the major war criminals who are in Spandau, have been amnestied. And this has to do with, certainly, the attempt to turn Germany from an enemy into an ally in the Cold War.
And then you're completely correct, and it is true in the East as well. That is to say, in fact, the Soviet Union begins building up an East German army several years before the Western Allies begin to build up a West German army. And for the same reason that the Americans and British and French are releasing convicted war criminals from jail before their terms, whatever they were sentenced to, are up. So the Soviet Union insists that the East German government that they have installed there in their zone of occupation is also releasing criminals who had earlier been sentenced to various kinds of confinement. But that is essentially, I would suggest, a development that starts in 49 and is more or less completed by 56 or 57.
You kept bringing up the idea of liberation. From when the Germans were coming back from their destruction of Germany to destroying themselves, to the Holocaust, and so on and so forth. So let me ask you this. What, in your words, is your perspective of liberation?
Well, I think we've been trying to show that it is a very multicolored and mixed bag what liberation means. There is no denying that I think what again I call sort of a North American perspective of a, you know, a great triumph at the end of this war, to that countries are liberated, that camps are liberated, that people who were about to die no longer are going to die. And some of that is really a very good story. But liberation, as we said, means very different things on very different fronts and to different populations. And where liberation in the West is ultimately a positive thing, it looks very different in the East. So it would be, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could just say, this is what liberation is? But the conversation could go on for another 24 hours, and it would all have very different perspectives on what it actually means. I'm sorry it's not a simple answer, but it is. I think it would be a mistake to see it as a very simple process.
Yes, and the other aspect of this is both in the positive and negative sense, it's very much also a matter of timing. Mm-hmm. If the war had ended a week earlier, thousands more would have survived.
Yeah.
If it had lasted a week longer, literally thousands more would have died. We tend to forget that in any major conflict, the number of people who die or get killed is every week larger than the preceding week. Mm-hmm. And that gives you some way of thinking about the time factor up to liberation, since there was no predetermined rule what day that was going to happen.
Historian Timothy Snyder has argued that German atrocities were worst in areas where the state had been destroyed, like Poland, or areas that had suffered double invasion, the Soviets in 39 and 40, and then the Germans in 41. I was wondering if you could comment on that?
Whether the state was destroyed or wasn't destroyed had nothing to do with the subject of the horrors. The state was destroyed in Luxembourg, and Luxembourg was annexed literally to Germany already during the war. People were killed there. Lots of Poland was annexed, and lots of Poland was not annexed. People were slaughtered in both parts. The atrocities depended overwhelmingly on the German assessment in their imagination of the racial categories of the people they conquered. The Danes, Norwegians, Dutch, and the Welsh part of Belgium were to be, as honorary Aryans, part of the super race that would inherit the globe. And those who did not fit into this would either be ruled as inferiors, like the French-speaking parts of Belgium, the Walloons, the French, who were obviously inferior people, but could be ruled and would be allowed to survive, at least for a while, whereas Slavic peoples were going to disappear from the face of the earth. And any babies and kids that looked Germanic would be kidnapped and taken by the thousands into Germany and turned over to German couples. And the rest would either be killed, or if their experimentation in the concentration camps worked out, mass sterilized so that they could work on factories, farms, and mines, but would have no children. So the atrocities were related to the German imaginary stationing on a racial scale of the people they conquered. Whether these were supposedly Nordic Aryans and potentially superior when they got brains enough to realize what they were, as opposed to such idiotic things as many of the Norwegians thought, that they wanted to be independent of Germany. Imagine such a thing. They didn't realize that they were super Aryans, but they could learn. Whereas there was no way that a Slavic person could change his or her race. And there was no way that a Jewish person could change. Conversion to Christianity would in no way change anybody's grandparents. There was, if you will, a kind of idiotic coherence here in the thinking. If it all depends on your grandparents, there isn't a thing that a single person in this room can today do to change his or her grandparents. And so those who were Slavic were gonna be either killed or sterilized. And the fact that some of them were fluent in German language was irrelevant. You did not, as Hitler always said and explained to the German people in his writings and speeches, you can Germanize soil, but you cannot Germanize a person. If they aren't Aryan to begin with, you cannot, it's too late to change their grandparents. Mm-hmm. But you can change the soil, the land, by settling good, solid Aryans on it. You have to see it in these terms, because from the beginning to the end, this is the policy that is coherently, insistently, and horrendously applied.
And this is where you see a racial worldview, because conversion would have made things worse, according to the Nazi vision, because that would have made these people invisible and even more dangerous as the kind of vermin or parasite that was used in that racial language. So, absolutely.
Thank you to Dr. Gerhard Weinberg and Dr. Rebecca Whitman for this insightful program, and to Northern Trust for their support. To learn more about our guests or the museum and library, visit in person or online at PritzkerMilitary.org. Thank you, and please join us next time on Pritzker Military Presents.
Pritzker Military Presents is made possible by members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library and its sponsors. The views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily those of the museum and library. If you would like to be a part of our studio audience, become a member, or learn more, visit PritzkerMilitary.org. The preceding program was produced by the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.